This is a Power 98.7 podcast. Now we're talking. Subscribe to Power 98.7 podcasts in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. There's more on power987.co.za.
So what is happening in the world around us? Well, Denmark, Finland, Iceland, New Zealand, Germany and Slovakia are all countries that responded particularly well to the COVID pandemic by creating the kinds of interventions that reduced the infection rates, lessened the period for lockdown closures, worked towards herd immunity approaches, and provided access to vaccines and got people back to work sooner rather than later. The one common denominator is that at the time, all of these were countries run by women. The outcomes were so remarkable that Harvard University ran a study to find out why it is that they did so well. And the simple answer is that women leaders are able to place themselves in the shoes of families affected by something like a pandemic. They ask themselves, how susceptible are the children to an infection? When can the mom go back to work? Can the dad provide additional care? And when they answer those questions at that very granular level, they make the policy adjustments and they make sure that they make the kinds of interventions and allocate the resources that are needed accordingly. In another study, the World Economic Forum looked at companies that hired more women, especially at senior executive level, and have found that these companies increased their profitability because more diversity leads to seeking and exploring wider markets, creating sales channels, and leading towards something called the triple bottom line. Now, these are studies from Harvard University, from the World Economic Forum, and it's just data gathered after the COVID pandemic as to which countries recovered quickly. Countries led by women. But let's see if there's any more data to support this theory that when countries or companies are led by women, they perform better. We're joined by Dr. Supriya Karigipati, who's an associate professor in gender and development studies or development economics at the University of Liverpool. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
So, thank you very much. So, Dr. Karigipati, can you tell us, is it true that countries led by women are generally better governed nations?
We really don't know the answer to that question. But certainly, when we compare like-for-like countries that were male-led and female-led, during the COVID-19 pandemic, we found that there was a certain advantage to belong to the female-led countries. Female-led countries had significantly fewer COVID cases and deaths. In fact, what we find is the results on deaths were stronger than the results on cases. And if you think about it, this is a performance indicator because what it suggests is that although female-led countries were equally hard hit by COVID, they actually managed the virus better in terms of having fewer fatalities.
And so what would you attribute that to? Was it just existing very good programs on healthcare or just decisive leadership in the midst of this pandemic?
Now, this is a really important question, and I'd like to take some time to answer it.
Please.
As there are actually two issues nested within it. So the first issue is what leaders actually did, and the second is why they did what they did. So when we look at what leaders did, we find that when we compare similar countries, women leaders actually acted faster and acted decisively. And they also communicated their decisions in ways that are likely to have elicited greater compliance from their citizens. So let me just use an example to explain this. So if you recollect, in the early days of the pandemic, the only policy instrument that was available to leaders to control transmission of the virus was to lock down their economy. So when we examine what leaders did with this instrument, we find that women leaders locked down their economies significantly earlier than male leaders. To be precise, 24 deaths sooner, which means that male leaders waited that much longer. They waited for more deaths to happen before they locked down their economies. Now, women leaders did this at great risk to their economies. We also find that female leaders have used styles of communications and modes of communications that were distinct and at times even experimental. We believe that these may have contributed to greater compliance with the new emergency measures that were put in place. For instance, Jacinda Ardern's using Facebook Live to daily check in with citizens, and Angela Merkel's intuitive explanation of the complex science as a basis of policy. And there are several other examples. For instance, Erna Solberg's conference with children to talk to them directly about the virus. Now, I did say that there was a second issue nested within your question, and this is perhaps the more important one, and that is to ask what are the fundamental drivers that make female leaders act differently from their male counterparts. We believe, and we have basis for this belief, is that this fundamental driver is empathy. And you yourself mentioned something about women putting themselves in the shoes of the families that are suffering pandemic. We see this very clearly when we compare the speeches made by national leaders in the initial stages of the pandemic. This was an unprecedented time when, you know, things were rather raw. There was no hindsight or no learning curve that could support the leaders, what they were thinking or saying. So when we examine these speeches to see if there exist differences in styles and language that leaders use, our results show that female leaders are twice as likely to empathize with the seriousness of the crisis and are focused on saving lives by empowering their citizens. Whereas male leaders always suggest that their governments are there to protect their citizens. So the approaches to protection, to controlling the transmission of the virus are very different. And female leaders' approaches clearly based on empathy and empowerment.
And what you've just said in the answer you've given holistically, you know, the communication tools were important. This is the case, you said, in New Zealand. Speaking directly to children as a constituency, a stakeholder group, was one other intervention, as you mentioned, in the Nordic countries. And then simplifying the science. So again, you know, it's not just the empathy that we're referring to. It's the humanizing and personalizing the problem beyond statistics.
Absolutely. And I think these styles of communication that leaders adopted were extremely effective. You know, it's not simply enough to say there is a virus, it may affect you, and the government is here for you. This is exactly what the male leaders were saying. But the female leaders were saying, look, there is a virus, take it seriously. And this is what you can do to, you know, protect yourself. And clear measures were put in place. And the reasons, the sort of scientific reasons behind the policies that were put in place were actually given. So citizens were thought to be an entity that was intelligent and deserved the explanation for why things were being done. And this is really something that separates the female approach to communication from the male approach.
So not talking down to the citizenry and saying there's a pandemic, we've got it undercover, I will tell you where to go, what to do. It's literally walking the journey with the citizens because you recognize that they have agency.
Absolutely correct. And this is something that's clearly visible when we compare speeches that were given by female leaders versus speeches that were given by male leaders. Male leaders constantly talk about how governments are there to protect them, but female leaders talk about, you know, what is it that citizens themselves can do in order to protect them, why it is so important to take the virus seriously, and why should these things be done? So the real reasons, the scientific reasons behind, you know, social distancing, behind why lockdown was being imposed and so on.
Yeah, and even the language, the we versus the government, you know, we are in it together and the government versus something separate. Let's talk about, very briefly, whether or not in countries that are led by women, we see more social spending on public goods such as healthcare, education, sanitation, perhaps feeding schemes, you know, and supporting general sort of sustenance and sustainability issues versus defense spending. Is there any truth to that?
Well, again, this is a really important question. And there is one point that I'd like to make here before actually going into the broader literature. You know, doing research that directly compares the performance of national leaders is immensely difficult, simply because of the paucity of female-led countries.
Yes.
This was by far the biggest challenge we faced. Just 10% of our sample of over 200 countries were led by a woman. This imbalance in the sample between male and female-led countries means that standard statistical techniques cannot be employed. Gathering data becomes a huge challenge, and answering the very important questions you've answered becomes close to being really impossible. So we used a novel neighborhood matching methodology to match similar female-led countries with male-led countries. And this is possible only at one point in time. So comparing indicators over time, or what we refer to as longitudinal data analysis, mm-hmm. is massively difficult. And that is actually what we need in order to answer those questions robustly, right? Despite these difficulties, we are trying to examine indicators you mentioned and others at various points in time to examine trends in leaders' performance. But, you know, not all is lost. For instance, we can look at broader literature to find that there's plenty of evidence to support our claim that female leaders are different, and at least in some circumstances, these differences are advantages. I mean, I'd like to mention the famous the work by the famous American psychologist, Professor Eagly, who has dedicated her career to understanding the differences in the way men and women approach leadership. I absolutely love Eagly's work. And for those who are interested in this question, it is really worth diving into. She and her co-authors talk about a female leadership advantage under contemporary conditions. And similar work can be found by Ryan and his team, who found that women tend to be favored as leaders during a crisis. Mm-hmm. And they're also selected to contest hard-to-win elections. So if you look at how parties behave and where they put their female MPs to contest from, you will find that they actually put them in hard-to-win constituencies because, you know, women can actually turn those constituencies around. And again, you also mentioned some research with CEOs. There is a fantastic work by Palvia. They find strong evidence that smaller banks with female CEOs and chairmen were less likely to fail during the financial crisis. So there's plenty of evidence out there to support the idea that women provide successful leadership.
I'd like us to go into the business conversation in a short while, now that we've established at least some parameters of understanding how women lead, personalized, in empathy, and actually apparently best suited in a crisis.
Thought-provoking conversations with Lerato Mbele. 9 a.m. to midday.
And our conversation on this Women's Day, 9th of August 2022, is whether or not countries led by women generally perform better than others. And as I said earlier on the program, we're not talking the big GDP data, you know, because that's about trade and output and industry. But we're just saying the quality of life for citizens, is it better when women are in charge or not? And that's really the measure of development. Do more children go to school? More people have access to primary health care? Do we change how industries work to introduce a modicum of gender pay parity? Is that how women lead? And the evidence before us is during the COVID pandemic, it is absolutely true, indisputable, that women-led countries came out of that pandemic faster, stronger, and better with fewer infections than any other country. That was one very, very visible test on women leadership. And what we're being told by Dr. Supriya Garikpati from the University of Liverpool's Management School is that it has a lot to do with how women lead, with empathy, supported by the scientific data, but communicating it regularly so that all citizens recognize how they can seize opportunities to be part of the solution, that women do that. They engage much more actively than male leaders, it seems, and that's what happened with COVID. But we were also talking, Dr. Garrick Partey, about research from the World Economic Forum that's looked at companies that hire more women. And in fact, I have to be honest, it's not just more women, it's also who hire on the diversity quotient. So more women, more minorities, racial minorities, and members of the LGBTQI community, that when companies are deliberate in hiring more of those people into their staff complement, they do better as corporations. Could you explain to us why?
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, the importance, it's important, you know, for the world to recognize that diversity in leadership, as in other things, is not merely a way of ensuring or signaling gender equality, which may have its own value, but it is actually a way to promote efficiency. For instance, you know, our study points to the idea that women's leadership is different, and that in the context of the pandemic, which posed a very particular kind of challenge, this different style of leadership actually proved to be better. And let's admit it, that these types of challenges are likely to become more rather than less common. Given that challenges countries and organizations face vary in their context and characteristics, mm-hmm. it seems clear that diversity in leadership will prove to be a major advantage in managing and minimizing risks. Such diversity then is not simply a matter of equity. It becomes a matter of efficiency. And this is the reason why, you know, there's a push for diversity among, you know, boards, among CEOs, among higher executives in I did give you that example earlier, right? The research by Palvia, which shows that actually banks, smaller banks with female CEOs and chairwomen were less likely to fail during the 2008 recession.
Yeah.
So, you know, it is not only signaling gender equality, but it is actually quite centrally important for better management and more effectiveness.
And I'm sure you're aware of the example of the Grameen Bank in India. Not a perfect example, but it's a kind of a micro lender, but targeting particularly women traders and women farmers. And the reason why they have targeted women in particular is because they, from their experience, women pay back their loans faster than men. And so they present less risk to a lender. And that's why the bank was created, particularly for women in the informal sectors, in agriculture and in trading, because they knew that the little bit of cash that they get given, it comes back, and then they start to multiply it incrementally. That women have this kind of moral obligation to make sure that they pay their debts.
Well, that is actually, you know, there's a lot of controversy surrounding it. The other side of the coin is that, you know, women are more vulnerable, they are less mobile, the banks can catch them more easily, and therefore they are and they are much more likely to comply because they are not aggressive and assertive and so on and so forth. So there are lots of negative attributes that go with this for why women are targeted. But the other side of the argument is women are much more likely to share their economic wealth with the next generation. When women earn and bring in money into their homes, their children are likely to enjoy better education and better nutrition. And this intergenerational development outcomes actually conform to the idea that women can be relied upon in order to, you know, improve the overall financial and sort of social indicators of their household. And that's the reason why women can be relied upon to sort of take that development journey forward.
A final question to you is about Africa. And I'm not sure how much of your research extends to the subcontinent. But we see the women are the majority of the population across the subcontinent, but there's something quite challenging when it comes to elections, and it's difficult for constituencies to actually elect a woman into a leadership position. So most women who've become presidents and vice presidents, or most women who've become leaders, let me just say that, were elected or appointed on a technicality because they were a running mate to someone else, or some, or a president died or resigned and then they were appointed into the role. It's not always direct election, except for Ellen Johnson Sirleaf in Liberia, and now recently Samia Suluhu in Tanzania. What do you attribute this to? Because women are the majority of the population. People write poems about the beauty and the wonderments of women. But what makes it tricky to just say, I trust a woman with the destiny of a country?
You know, this is so fundamental to how we think. Much of the dominant discourse within the leadership literature has remained, unfortunately, heavily masculinized, where leadership is associated with masculine attributes like assertiveness and authoritarianism. And this, perhaps inadvertently, has influenced perceptions around how leaders should behave. So women are often asked to lean in and to conform to behavior expected of a leader. These impositions suggest an acceptance of the absolute dominance of certain traits of leadership that are always deemed to be successful, and which women are constantly asked to imbibe if they are to succeed. So this is the huge problem. You know, this is the reason why women are not encouraged in their true form to become leaders. And you're talking about Africa, sort of made me think about Namibia, which was a very interesting case. We had to do a lot of reading into the Namibia's political system in order to figure whether it was female-led or male-led, because it had a political leadership, both female and male. So, yes, you're right. And this dominant discourse needs to be changed. There are several practical things that countries can do to ensure more political participation from women. For instance, you know, open dialogue and discussions about this topic. Simply stop telling our children, both male and female, that they cannot be themselves and have to emulate attributes that are alien to them in order to succeed. Several countries have also experimented with quotas, with partial success, of course. Quotas need to be monitored to ensure that they're actually improving effective female representation. So there's a lot that can be done. But the first step remains to recognize that women whose empathetic and cooperative attitudes have been associated with weakness and subordination can actually use these very glorious attributes to be hugely successful leaders.
I thank you so much for what an enlightening conversation, Dr. Supriya Garikipati, who is the Associate Professor in Gender and Development Economics at the University of Liverpool's Management School. And Pastor Tace sends us a wonderful shout out as the Women of Power 98.7. We thank you so much for that. And he sent us a poster which says, a woman, W, wonderful wife, O, outstanding friend, M, marvelous daughter, A, adorable sister, N, nurturing woman. Happy Women's Day.
You've been listening to a Power 98.7 podcast. For more podcasts, visit power987.co.za or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.